Okay, thanks, Kerry, and thanks NCARP for hosting this. It's sort of really timely to 3 years since we had our last big terrestrial biodiversity climate change conference and workshop. So it's sort of, I think it's really important that we continue to refresh ourselves with the science. It's sort of, it's really hard to keep up with this, and it's constantly moving. And I think it's even just the interactions that are happening today is really worthwhile. So I'm just going to give you a couple of snapshots of some of the things we're doing in Department of Primary Industries, Parks, Water and Environment, the State Conservation Agency, DPPWE, it'll be referred to after this, and I'm in the Resource Management and Conservation Division. We've got, I'm just going to talk about the terrestrial stuff today, but we've also got projects happening in geoconservation and climate change, marine, particularly seabird and mammal monitoring and work, and in the ag primary industry side of thing, and in freshwater systems. So quite a lot of things happening. Okay, one of the key things, we've got a four-year major initiative, Natural Systems Resilient to Climate Change. So we've got this project that's the umbrella to across the division in different branches in the different sections. That's flora, fauna, et cetera, weeds. And what we're looking at is this project, how do we ensure that Tasmania's natural environments sort of persist and thrive, are healthy and resilient in a changing climate? And looking after all those special places and special values that we as Tasmanians and Australians, the rest of the world really value. And our focus is to try and look, two things. We're not going to do it by ourselves, so it's collaborating, working with partners, working with you guys to try and ensure that we sort of build adaptation and facilitate sort of change where necessary. And the other side of it is, I've forgotten one. Working with our partners. We've got two key phases or two key planks to this. It's looking at the vulnerability side of things and also looking at developing management responses. Actually, that was the other plank, is how do we mainstream all of this, all this science, the vulnerability, into our agency's core responsibility is the conservation and sustainable management of our natural values, our natural resources. How do we mainstream all of this sort of climate thinking into our policy responses, our management responses, planning, etc. Our first major output under this project has been the production with a team of people, an overview of the vulnerability of the terrestrial, marine and freshwater biodiversity. Really high level sort of picture being informed particularly by international work, national workshops and then our own workshop 3 years ago. I won't read out the key vulnerabilities, but I'll just flag one there that I think is a really major challenge for us, that is probably one of the big unknowns, is the complex and cumulative interactions between the current threats and disturbance regimes, fire, weeds, pest diseases, and climate exacerbating on all those other communities. Okay, I just want to give a plug. Chloe mentioned it, some of the best climate projection work available globally, but I'm not sure if in Tasmania we really appreciate that we've got this incredible fine-scale climate projections off to 2100, six models, two scenarios, a high-emission scenario and a low-emission scenario. There's some fantastic tools there, and I'm really plugging it to make sure that we all start using it as part of our adaptation planning and thinking. There's a series of reports out or about to be out. The extreme events, for example, is about to be released the end of this month. Really important one, I think I've forgotten it, Dave, who talked about the tails, but I think if we can cope with extreme events regardless of climate change, we're pretty on that track for adaptation options. Some of the work we're doing in DPPWE with Felicity Faulkner, who's down there, I'll point out a few people today, so go and talk to them at lunchtime, is trying to, well, not trying, converting some, Climate Futures has got 75 terabyte of data, 144 variables. It's pretty unapproachable. You've got to, and at 6 minute intervals. So we've extracted some of the key variables that we think are useful from an ecological, biological point of view to use for modelling and predictive approaches, converting them into seasonal and decadal data sets. And again, this is, we're doing the hard work at the moment, but it'd be great to collaborate, partner with people. If we've done the work and you're about to do some modelling yourselves, you know, perhaps use this rather than spending a year converting the data yourself into the appropriate format. We're doing some work also looking at the major ecosystem types. So this one's the highland treeless, the alpine systems in Tassie. Using the data to look at where's the current extent of this community, which is shown in the blue, and the broader, the yellow, is the current climate envelope. And then looking at, in 2100, where's that same climate existing, and where would we project that that ecosystem extent would be? We haven't done this yet. We're about to start looking at these sort of things, and again, we would love to be working with other people who are thinking this way. So one of the other key planks we're doing that Dave particularly mentioned is monitoring, looking at monitoring requirements under climate change. So to this end, we commissioned Dr. Mick Brown to undertake a review, well, two reviews for us on the monitoring needs of the impact of climate change on the flora values, particularly in the Western Tasmania World Heritage Area as a globally significant, internationally and nationally significant biodiversity value. He also undertook a complementary, smaller project looking at monitoring needs in the rest of the state, but particularly in the drier eastern ecosystems. Part of that work was also to identify where we had data, they're not not even long-term data sets, but just where we had data that could be built on, particularly for student projects over time. Another piece of work that Jenny Winham's been involved with was looking at collaboration with the university on student projects using some of this data. One of the key recommendations that these reports identified was in the World Heritage Area, we hardly had any weather stations, so it was really hard. You know, on the maps that Leslie showed earlier, Tasmania is two data points. So we've now got data down to 720 grid squares in Tassie, down to 14 kilometres. But we've still got very few weather stations out in the southwest. So this is the installation of a weather station on Kerry's not favourite place, Mount Sprent, looking as part of a tree line ecotone study. We're also, there's going to be another one put in this summer on the Cradle Plateau. The other key thing that was identified was the importance of developing a vegetation monitoring strategy. And Tim Rudman, who's not here today, that's something that he's pushing through and developing at the moment. Okay, as I mentioned, the World Heritage Area, real priority for us in terms of the values and the monitoring. So a couple of the projects we're doing there, one's the conifer monitoring, looking at our endemic, we've got a suite of endemic conifers in the state. So looking at conifer health. A number of you have probably noticed over the years, particularly if you drive up Mount Field, since I moved to Tassie, I think the ones on the roads have almost died. But you're going around and you're starting to see sort of evidence of sick and unhealthy pine trees. The ones here in the top with the crown damage at Dixon's Kingdom. The other project, important project for the World Heritage Area, is looking at the extent and the condition of Feldmark, a vegetation type that's reliant on frost and wind, and climate's a really key driver. So what's happening with our Feldmark areas? And the other component that is happening is Climate Watch, the role of citizen science. We've got Mick Fitzgerald down the back room, back corner. What happened?
I suspect that it's plugged in.
Ah, flat battery.
Just here.
So while we're plugging in, Climate Watch is a citizen science program that's run by the Bureau of Meteorology, Melbourne Uni, Rio Tinto, and there's probably other sponsors I've forgotten. Focus on the phenology and getting people to to note observations and changes in observations. Lee Belbin was saying it before we started. He's got a mate who walks across somewhere in Canberra to work and every day notices what's in flower, what birds, things like that. And they all go into programs like this, citizen science, and really valuable information with long-term trends. This is in Tas Regions, which is online on Te Pitwi's website. This is an article that Nick's just written. Okay, so other part of our work is the development of spatial layers using the climate futures data for modelling, trying to get a handle on where are those places that are particularly important for planning purposes. And one of the key ones, and one of the key gaps in terms of where we need more information, again, partnership with you guys, is refugia. Trying to get a handle on where are they, what for. Refugia such as paleoclimatic refugia, the places that have hung on since the Holocene, but also refugia from contemporary processes like fire and weeds. Where are the places that have, haven't been burnt or hardly ever burnt or weed-free, phytophthora-free, trying to get a handle on those places. And then looking at management options. How do we protect those places, which is where things may retreat to in unfavourable times and may actually radiate out and colonise back out when things get more favourable. One of the conversations I had with Adrian Perk and Dave Taylor at morning tea was if we identify these refugia, would we find it acceptable, and it leads into what Dave was talking about, would we have nice bright green fire breaks all the way around those really important places? Is that acceptable? Could we stomach that to protect what we see as biologically really important, or would we think that disturbs the pristineness, the wildness, and it's unacceptable? And they're the debates we need to have as a scientific community, and then to inform the broader community. So we're going to run a series of workshops over the next 6 months on refugia. So if you're interested in being involved, we've got Jenny or Oberon Carter at this table, Felicity, myself, John Harkin, who's looking at the role of the private land system in terms of building resilience. Come and talk to us at lunchtime and put your name on a list. Okay, we've got a small little, just something to wake you up, change the pace. On each of the tables, there's some sheets which somebody can hand out on each of your tables just to get a bit of audience interaction, and we'd really value this.
Tell me if you haven't got enough sheets.
And I'll keep talking, but I just like the tables. If you don't want to fill it out, that's fine. If you only want to put one place. But we thought between all of you, with the range of interests you've got and experience, knowledge about Tassie, we'd like to get a better handle on where people think or know there's refugia for their species, their thing. Or it might be just the place that you think you love going to the Ballroom Forest at Cradle Mountain because it's got all those ancient conifers and all those relictual species, and you think that's, you know, a wonderful place. So while I'm talking, just if you can put down any, then we'll collect them later or do it at lunchtime, that'd be great. The other, will I give you a minute or keep going? What do you reckon? People doing the task now, they look like they're concentrating, so maybe I'll leave it for a minute.
Go back to the examples.
Yeah. You've got some of the examples of the types of refugia. Physical refugia, like caves and canyons, where things can hang out because of fires and things don't get there. And the next little task we're going to do is a similar thing, but it's looking at fire-sensitive vegetation, which if you're thinking of fire refugia. Okay, I'll start moving on. I'll just talk about the research that's happening, particularly in the World Heritage area, but also with Adrian Perk and Dave Taylor down there from Parks and Wildlife Service. So there's a strong collaboration between the Resource Management and Conservation Division and Parks and Wildlife on research and management responses to increased fire, increased frequency, intensity, changed seasonality of fire. Dave Bowman and Mick Brown in the 80s commented that lightning was sort of not all that significant ecologically in Tasmania at that point in time. But in the past decade, it's become increasingly a major cause of wildfire in the World Heritage Area, something like 180,000 hectares in the last decade. That sort of order burnt from fire, lightning strikes, no longer accompanied by wet, drenching rains, but often just dry storms and wicking up the hill. So quite a significant impact. Dave and Adrian have developed, and others in the section have developed, a bushfire risk assessment model, the BRAM system. And for those who aren't familiar with the system, if you get the opportunity to hear them talking, it's a really good adaptive management risk assessment model, decision support sort of tool for fire planning. But they put in, and don't worry too much about the colours, but they put in a whole range of assets at risk, which include your houses, buildings, infrastructure, fire towers, you know, phone systems, but also the natural assets. And this is the map that is all the layers stuck on top of each other and showing just the range of risk factors. The other thing that, the other little task this morning we thought we'd get you to do is there's some places that in Tassie, I already mentioned Boreham Forest and Cradle Mountain. I'd be very devastated if, you know, those places went up in smoke, or Mount Reid with its unique conifers and the high altitude Huon pine. If any of you, from your point of view, have got some places that you could identify that the consequence, the loss, would be really catastrophic. You know, you'd be really devastated to see that place or that value disappear. Again, can you put that down? One, two or three places, whatever, put lots. But we seriously will feed them back to the guys doing the planning and for them to consider in this year's. This is a system that's dynamic. It's updated every year, given the current weather projections, and so it can be updated. So same sort of thing, name three places or less. Michael Dunlop, when he was here, and I think we've heard this challenge already this morning, sort of put out the challenge that conservation managers will need to embrace the new challenge of managing the change to minimise the loss. And I think that for us this afternoon, we really need to get down to some of those low-regret options for adaptation, but what are some of the high-risk ones that they've challenged us to undertake as well? And at least we should think through some of those options. Even if we rule them out as wacky, we should have an active sort of process. And somebody mentioned the cider gums on the Central Plateau being perhaps, the loss of frost. This is a very sad site of populations now up on Myena. Potentially our first climate change species casualty up there. Okay, and I'll just finish on leaving a list of those sort of adaptation options similar to what we saw before. I'll leave them up there to think about, again, for informing the discussion this afternoon. But I think the thing we need to do with these sort of options, which are high level and generic, and I already mentioned that before, like they usually say expand the protected area network, but in a place with a good protected area network, you're going to have to be very strategic and very convincing to get the money or the resources to do that. It's got to be a really high value, highly prioritised, targeted investment. Same with some of these other things, you know, greater connectivity in protected areas, but perhaps the World Heritage Area, we don't want fire wicks and conduits for weeds and pests and things up into that high country. Maybe connectivity, there's some places we don't want to have. So I'll just leave them there to think about. And any questions now or later?
Quick ones now.
Any quick questions?
Or comments for Louise? So we've got three stakeholders speaking, and there'll be a discussion after that, which will be facilitated by Leslie in the event. So we're going to keep going. Thanks, Louise.